Lord, Lord, it's good to be sober on a Sunday morning. My name is Mary, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm the only one here who doesn't have an accent. I would like, first of all, to start by thanking Betsy and Jennifer and Tony and Don and all the committee, Nina, for inviting me to this wonderful experience. When the phone rang, and I always pick it up when it rings, I heard Aloha, and I thought, my God, do I know anyone in Hawaii? Did I ever drink in Hawaii? I don't think so. And then my wonderful host and hostess, John and Jane, picked me up at the airport with a big sign, Aloha Mari and LA. And you know, what did I do to deserve all this? All I did was drink and lose everything of value in my life. But I truly believe that what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is the opportunity to have a meaningful life and to give back something of this miracle that was given to me. I am a very grateful alcoholic. And then to hear Amazing Grace played on the pipes. We have a saying in Scotland, it makes your blood boil. And it made my blood boil. And then hearing God Bless America. I want you to know that we feel very deeply for what has happened in Canada where I live now. And that your American flag is flying side by side with the Canadian flag. And I know back home in my country that the support is with you all. You see, I feel that Alcoholics Anonymous could only ever have begun in the United States of America. I truly believe that. I believe it because only there could a God of your own understanding have been accepted. It is an amazing thing to me that in 1935, two people came together, two men who were both from Vermont, yet had never known each other. That is some kind of miracle. You know, in Toronto in 2005, Canada is hosting the World Conference. The other day I was listening to a tape that was made in 1965 of Bill Wilson when he was last. We had the World Conference in Toronto in 1965, and Bill Wilson was there. And he was talking about the origins of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, you know, to me, the true founding, the beginnings of Alcoholics Anonymous, started in Switzerland in 1932. In 1932, an American called Roland Hazard, who was then what they called a dipsomaniac, was sent to Switzerland to see Dr. Carl Jung, who is mentioned in our big book. And Dr. Carl Jung treated Roland for a year, and after a year, he discharged him and said he was cured. And Roland headed back, and through France, he stopped for a little while, and somebody asked him the wrong question. They said, would you like a drink? And in a short time, he was back in Switzerland, and he said to Dr. Carl Jung, I thought I was cured. Carl Jung, according to AA archive literature, said to him, I misdiagnosed your case. He said, the truth is, I have never seen an alcoholic of your type recover. He said, I have heard about them once in a while, but I've never seen one. And what happens is that they have huge emotional displacements, like a spiritual experience, but they're very rare. And Roland said, well, I'm a Christian man. He said, that might not be enough. And Roland went back to the States, enrolled in the Oxford group, and then was asked to go to the assistance of Ebby, because Ebby had been taken to court one more time for alcoholism. And these people who went there on behalf of Roland, they asked the judge if they could have Ebby to look after him and try and get him sober, and the judge discharged him, and they took Ebby to the Oxford group. And eventually Ebby went to see his friends, because in the Oxford group at the time you had to testify. You had to say, I used to drink, but I don't anymore. And of course the person that Ebby went to was Bill Willison. And that is the amazing chain of events. We have a saying that coincidence is God's way of staying anonymous, and I think that's true. And the last thing I'll mention about that is in the letter that is in our archives, that Carl Jung wrote to Bill Willison when Bill had said, I want to thank you, because only you said that the alcoholic was beyond human aid. Carl Jung wrote back and said, you see, the word for spirit can mean the most depraving poison, or it can mean the highest spiritual experience. An alcoholic drinks spirit. He said, so therefore I think that the formula for the alcoholic is spiritus contra spiritum, which in Latin means spirit against spirit. And I know that for me, the only thing that relieved me of a hopeless condition of mind and body was when I adopted a spiritual program of action through the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous against the spirit in the bottle that I was beyond putting down on my own. So here we are at the 40th annual Hawaiian conference. I was coming down the elevator in the hotel, and this man looked at me and said, oh, what is that, interior decorator? Of course, I didn't know what he meant. I said, no, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, that's a very difficult thing to give up. I said, well, it's easy with God. And he just looked at me, of course. But then I'm thinking to myself, why did he say interior decorator? And then I look at my name tag and it says, a design for living, it really works. So I guess Alcoholics Anonymous is an interior decorator. Can I have my card? It's good. Thank you very much, Wally. I had to get you up here because I know how nervous you are. You don't want to be here alone. Thank you. So, I will tell you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. Please keep an open mind. I do not speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I have in my life is through Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born in Scotland and my parents were Irish. I used to think that's why I was nuts. I was always looking for something to blame. Being Irish, born in Scotland, I felt like a leprechaun in a Presbyterian church. I was always looking for magic and there wasn't any. You know, I grew up in a Roman Catholic household. They were good people. I was brought up by my granny and my grandfather. They had 11 children. My father went to sea. That's the only way he could keep any sanity. And my old grandfather was a coal miner. And I loved him. And he taught me to read when I was 4 years old. And he was my hero. But see, every Friday and Saturday night, my old grandfather would go to the bar. And he'd get drunk. And every Friday and Saturday night, he'd come staggering down the street, you know, from east to west, the way the drunk walks. And all the neighbors would be laughing at my hero. And my granny would be behind the curtain where Roland pinning a rosary. the two staples of the Irish household. And every Saturday when my old grandfather and me were walking up to church, he'd say to me, "I won't do it again, Princess. I won't do it again." A legacy that I was to bequeath to my children many, many times. I mean it. "I won't do it again, son." But sure, every Friday and Saturday night would be doing it again. And I learned the inconsistency of that from an early age. And I said to myself, "I will never drink. I'm not going to have my family waiting behind curtains with weapons for me." I had something a lot of alcoholics have, although you will never hear Al-Anon give us any credit for it, and that is I had a high IQ. And the only thing a high IQ has enabled me to do is I've never completed anything I've ever started. I get bored very quickly. And because of this high IQ, I was sent to a convent to be educated by the psychopathic nuns. Because I was always looking for something to blame, I blamed the nuns. But of course, they were trying to teach me to have character, and I didn't know that till I came to AA. I mean, I was always a character, but I never had any. And by the time I was 13, I was a rebel. You see, I don't know if you know anything about Glasgow, Scotland, but if you're Irish, you're a second-class citizen. And I used to run with street gangs, and I used to get into a lot of trouble. So in the last couple of years of schooling, before they kicked me out at age 15, I hadn't drank, but I was a bad act. And they refused to teach me, and they used to send me up outside of old Mother Philippa, the old head nun's office, and she used to look like a penguin. And she used to say to me, "If you will read that sign up there, it may do something for your measly little life." And I used to look at this sign and it said, "Of courtesy it is much less than courage of heart or holiness. But in my walks to me it seems the grace of God is in courtesy." And I thought, courtesy is the last thing I want. Today I learned it. I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that courtesy is what we have with each other. When they kicked me out of school, I got into a lot of trouble, and then I decided that one day I was going to clean up my act, and I hadn't had a drink yet. I went into nursing, I got bored, and then I went down to London, England. I went to London, England with the wrong idea. At those times, I thought, well, the English have destroyed the Irish and the Scots, and I'm going to go down there to Sassenachland and have them teach me how to be a lady. And I went down and I joined British Airways when I was 21. They taught me how to walk, how to talk, how to say yes, no, thank you, ma'am, how to use my knife and fork from the outside. And on the outside, I was looking good. But inside, I was beginning to fragment. You see, I'd done many things that I was ashamed of. I'd thrown away the God of my understanding a long time ago. I knew that if you were too close to me, you'd see that I really wasn't a very nice person. So therefore, I was a loner. I did the next best thing to drinking I could think of, and I got married. I got married, and I went to live in Kingston, Jamaica. And it was wonderful. I married a man that I loved, and as much as I knew how to love, and he loved me. He came from an old rum family. He didn't know my origins or who I really was. I had by this time adopted the persona of a lady with British Airways. I had a different accent. He married a figment of my imagination. And Jamaica was wonderful, and just after a year or so, my first child was born, and my God, I loved that little boy with every fiber of my being. But just after he was born, I thought I was going insane, and somebody said, "Have a drink." And I drank it. And for the first time in my life, my skin fit. That's all I know how to tell you. I at last had found the magic that I had been seeking all my life. Jamaica has 151 proof rum, and it is marvelous. It goes all the way down to your toes. You know, all my life I had looked at other people who had that ease and comfort that Dr. Silkworth talks about in the big book. He says men and women drink because they like the sense of ease and comfort that they get. And all my life I had watched people mix and mingle with an ease that I knew I would never have. Well, you give me two glasses of 151 proof rum, and I can work a room. And I am magnanimous. And I will ask you, how are you? And I will listen to what you have to say. And it was wonderful. And because it was so good, I immediately drank on a daily basis. Immediately. I drank every day, and I had an amazing tolerance. Now, my husband was a very well-respected man, and for about 4 years, I just did really well on alcohol. I could get up in the morning and have a little gin and tonic, play some tennis. My second child was born when I was well into my alcoholism, I believe. But I had maids and gardeners to look after my children. And my husband being so respected, I could go anywhere I wanted on the island. And I am a pure alcoholic. But I was looking for something. And in Jamaica, you have Rastafarians. And they believe in a god called Jah. And they have these big baskets of, I used to go and listen to them talk about, they read the Old Testament, and they're vegetarians, and they smoke pot. And I used to go to these things, these meetings, and they have these big baskets of sensimilia. And they used to say to me, "Mary, come try a little sensimilia, man." Look how the liquor is making your eyes red. I used to say, I don't want nothing that's going to screw up my brain. I'll stick to liquor, thank you. And I did. But you know, way back then, I saw the difference. I didn't know what I was looking at. But I saw the difference, really, between an alcoholic and a drug addict. I'm not talking a drug addict. I'm talking an alcoholic and a drug addict. I used to look at them, and they would have this big spliff, and it was so big you couldn't see their face, you know. And they used to go, "I just want a mellow old man." "Have a little vision." And they'd lie down and meditate. That's not me. When I drink, I want action. I want justice. Eventually, I was across. We have a book called Living Sober. It says when the cucumber becomes a pickle. I don't know when I became a pickle, but I stand before you a pickle. And I began to become obnoxious. I had the personality change. People now in Jamaica would call me and say, "Mary, I'm having a party, please don't come." And I am very sensitive, so I would go anyway. And now I have, of course, now I have two drinks and I lose it and I become the Glasgow street fighter that I always was. I'm not a lady anymore. And my husband said, "What is wrong with you? What's happened to you? You have a drink and you change." I was speaking in broad Glaswegian, which he didn't quite understand. And he said he was going to call my mother. Now, believe you me, my mother or my family or nobody should be calling about insanity. I mean, we have a very private kind of insanity. It doesn't hurt anybody, but it's in family, if you know what I mean. For example, I have an aunt, and she can be sitting having a cup of tea. And all of a sudden she freezes in time. And people will say, what happened to her? And they say, she's just away, she'll soon be back. They're dotted around my landscape, you know. So anyway, he couldn't get any help, and what happened to me is eventually I became obnoxious, I became arrogant, and I decided I was going to leave the island, divorce my husband, and take my children. Because, you see, the constant in my heart and soul was always a great love for my little boys. But I am an alcoholic, and I couldn't always act the way I wanted to act. I went back. Oh, there was a singer used to live across the road from me when I lived on Hope Road in Kingston, and his name was Bob Marley. Bob had bought a big, or rather been given this beautiful big palatial mansion. And he used to say, you're running and you're running and you're running away, but you can't run away from yourself. And many years later, I was to see in our literature what it said. We keep changing people, places, and things, but we never think about changing ourselves. It says in the big book, self manifested in various forms is the root of our problem. No matter where I go, I take myself along. Anyway, I got back to Scotland and they told me about my drinking, and I thought, I gotta get out of here. And a man called me that I had known. He said, let's get married. I'm a Canadian citizen. I thought, what a good idea. You see, I love getting married, but I have no follow through. But I love getting married. Not anymore, thank God. So this man and I got married. I took my little boys and I ended up in Calgary, Alberta. And when I landed in Calgary, Alberta, it was minus 40. And I realized I had made a bad decision. You got to drink a lot of rum in Calgary, Alberta. And by this time, I wake up in the morning and I'm shaking so bad I can't lift up my drink. And because I am a bright bunny, I realize I have a serious Valium deficiency. And I get a job as a pharmaceutical rep. And I'm a blackout drinker on the road. And don't ever say God can't drive, because God drove me around the prairies. I used to have blackouts and I'd leave one area and not remember the next one. And thank God I never killed anybody. Now the man I had married, my second husband, he was a born-again Christian. He was a good man. He knew I needed some kind of a spiritual help. He had me jumping for Jesus for a while and I didn't drink. But not for long, unfortunately. That wasn't my solution. But the other thing was, he wouldn't work. I used to say to him, don't you think you should get a job? He used to say, God would provide. We know that God helps those who help himself, right? So in the end, that nice, gentle man, I sent him away. And now it's just me and my two little boys. And I am the only adult figure that my children have in Canada. And they're 9 and 5. And my little boys would come home and I'd be drunk out, passed out in the carpet. And they'd wake up in the morning and I'd be drunk, passed out in the carpet. I'd drive with them drunk in the back of the car. They'd see me bring people home that I shouldn't have brought home. And the only reason I have any peace with that today is because I have done the amends. And I never ever physically abused my children, but they were a victim of alcoholism as sure as if they had drunk it. And now I know that I need help. I know that I can't stop drinking anymore. I've crashed the company car. I've given up the job, whatever. I can't remember what happened there. And I'm crying for help. And I have something a lot of alcoholics have, and it's called alcoholic telephonitis. I don't know if you've ever suffered from it. Alcoholic telephonitis is a phenomenon that never attacks in a day. Alcoholic telephonitis usually approaches around midnight. When you're sitting alone with your jug and you want to call somebody and tell them how you've been screwed by the world. But you don't want to call anybody nearby because they might come. So what you do is you call other countries. You forget there's a time change. When you wake them up and they say hello, you pass out. I have these two old aunts, my mother's sisters. They're virgin aunts. They're warriors. And they're good people. And they came to Calgary, Alberta from Scotland and told me I had early menopause and put me in detox. And that's called Irish rationalization. Now, when I was in detox, something wonderful happened to me. You see, I didn't know what was wrong with me. I'd never heard about alcoholism. Back home, they just called them drunk. I'd never heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought I was a crazy Irish person. CIA, Catholic Irish Alcoholic, you know, I didn't think. And what happened when I was in detox is it was just me and five Native Canadians. And they would hold my soup to me and my coffee to me when I was shaking too much to hold it by myself. They told me that they were in to dry out for the summer. They told me that they drank because their spirit was broken. And I thought about that. And I thought, you know, I'm a bad act, but there's something that has been decent inside of me. There is something maybe a God of God, but it's broken. And maybe it can never heal. So when I got out of there, my family went back to Scotland, and I decided I was going to go back to the Caribbean. 10 days I was without liquor, and I started drinking again. I thought if I went back to the Caribbean, I will have things the way they used to be. I always wanted to get back to where it used to be, where I could drink and get that warm, wonderful feeling. But it's gone forever, except I didn't know that. And I took my children back to the Caribbean. And I thought, this time it's going to be different. This time. And their father asked me, he was remarried, he asked me if he could have my children for a week. And they were gone for 13 years. And Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't healed the crack in my heart. And my God hasn't healed the crack in my heart. But if there's anyone here who I can ever help so that you do not lose any years of your precious children's life, then that's why I'm here. I had my first... Yes. I had my first suicide attempt. I drank 151 proof rum and Valium. And, you know, they say in Jamaica, you're hard to dead. Alcoholics are hard to dead. We do not die easy. You know, I have people in Toronto, they come and they say, Mari, I know if I drink again, I'd be dead. I say, you wish. You wish. Some of us live forever drinking. I think that what it talks about when it's in the big book, when it says we will die if we drink again, it means that we will become the living dead, where we walk around but we have no spirit. They found me, they pumped out my stomach. Psychiatrist came to me the next day and told me something that was very observant, it was intellectually correct, and it was definitely relevant to my condition. The psychiatrist said to me, you mustn't do that anymore. My worst remember when is coming out of an old rundown hotel in Kingston with my escort of the night before. If there's anybody here who was a tourist in Jamaica in 1980, I'd like to make amends. I want somebody to go through the night with me, not because I want a hot, passionate night. I was long past having a hot, passionate night. I wanted somebody like me to go through the night drinking with me because when he's like me, alcoholic like me, we drink and things become possible. But for a non-alcoholic, they look despairing. And him and me will have a few drinks and we both look real good. And him and me will go into the enchanted cottage. The only thing is the sun comes up. And then there's the shame and the loneliness and the degradation. And him and me were walking out of this old hotel and a car passed by with my ex-husband, his new wife, and my two children that I wasn't allowed to see. And I was to know much more degradation and shame, but that was the worst. I left the island and went to Miami to drink myself to death. It is very difficult. I'd never heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. The drunk of my type, I got a little apartment. I'd drink, pass out, they'd steal my furniture. I'd drink, pass out, they'd steal my clothes. They'd take that which I had to give and that which I did not have to give. I ended up selling my blood for $20 a pint and living at the bottom of Lincoln Road on Miami Beach on Skid Row. And if you can't get there, or you say, I'll never get there, say yet. Say yet. Because if you be an alcoholic of my type, and you have lost everything of value in your life, you will get where I got. And that is why I cannot believe this miracle that I am standing here today, by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I started drinking, I was 25, I had long black hair, I was 112 pounds. I now have white matted hair, I'm about 160 pounds. I'm so swollen, not from eating. The only shoes I could get on my feet were a size 10 and a half flip flop. The rubber cut in and was embedded in my feet and I had to have them cut out. I panhandled off an old woman who used to live in Jamaica, an old English woman, and she now lived in Fort Lauderdale. And she got in touch with my parents. And my aunt came again, sobered me up, and asked me where I wanted to go. I said, I want to go back to Canada. And I went back to, I went to Alberta, to Calgary. I had some friends there. Met a man that I'd known for many years. You know, that's the story of my life. Anytime I need a bailout, I fall in love. And this man was a good man, and he said he would help me. And the first time I tried to kill him, he took me to a psychiatrist. And the second time I attacked him with a knife, he took me to the mental institution. And I used to love being in the mental institutions. I loved it. I love being institutionalized. They give me all these wonderful pills and I can sleep 22 hours a day and they just wake me up for meals. And you know the alcoholics in the mental institutions and the psychiatric wards. We all have 3 packs of cigarettes, paper slippers, and we're so zonked that we can't walk straight. And the only excitement is when you drop your lighted cigarette on your paper slipper. And you're too zonked to do anything. And we never tell the truth. The psychiatrist used to say to me, do you drink? I'd say, just a little. Just a little. I'd say, it's a man I've married, you see. I was always blaming something. The last time I was taken there, I was taken by the police, and I was in a lot of trouble. And it took them a long time to get me stable. Every combination of drugs you can think of to try and get me stable. Because I'd gone into the fetal position. I'd just had enough, I think. And just before I was being discharged, the psychiatrist called me and said, I've had to write something to keep you out of court, out of prison. And he let me read it, because he'd looked after me for a few years. And it said, chronic alcoholic, abnormal personality, and depressive. Now, those are all true. But I haven't had any medication. Now, some people will, but I'm saying I haven't had any since the 10th of August, 1984, which is my dry date. The prosecuting attorney wanted to put me away, and the defense said, Your Honor, this woman has suffered tragic social circumstances. And that about summed up my life. I was a tragic social circumstance. Now, they had taken me to some AA meetings, but I was too zonked out in pills when I was in the hospitals to understand. And one night I was sitting and I was drinking myself sober. It's a terrible place to be. And I picked up the phone and I phoned AA. And a man called Stan C with 29 years sobriety came in Edmonton, Alberta. I saw Jack here. Are you there, Jack? Jack helped me so much. He came up and said hi. He was there in the beginning for me. Amazing. Stan said to me something that nobody had ever said before. He said, I think you're one of us. And I said to him, I know I'm an alkie, Stan, but I'm also nuts. I got a psychiatric report that says I'm nuts. He says, Mary, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is like 12 adjustable wrenches if any nut that comes through the door. That got my attention. I had 4.5 months, but I couldn't find a God of my own understanding, and I had one slip. I told you my dry date's the 10th of August, 1984. On the 9th of August, 1984, some people from AA came in to shoot me to a meeting, and I was in very bad shape. They tell me I was shaking so much, strangers were waving back at me. That night, a little gal called Linda spent the night with me. And the next day she said, I'm going to leave, you know, because you're a loser. And I only stick with winners in Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I go, I'm going to ask you to kneel down and say the third step prayer. I said, so I don't kneel for nothing. And then something said, think of your children's eyes. I knelt down, I held her hands, and I repeated the third step prayer after her. And from that moment to this, I have had no desire for a drink. Some unmerited gift of grace was given to me, or if not that, some involuntary surrender where I couldn't take any more. And I am so truly grateful. But does that mean that I'm a well-functioning human being? I don't think so. I mean, I was pretty winged before I drank. I had a lot of personality defects, and I'm sure I'm going to have them just because I'm not drinking anymore. I remember an old gal out west, I used to shoot to say, you got to change. I said, how do I change? I don't think I'll ever change. She says, you quit doing the things you don't like yourself for, and you start doing the things you do like yourself for. And I remember how much I loved AA, but I couldn't hold my head up. Because I felt these people, these women, haven't been where I've been. They're better than me. And somebody said, if you start feeling different in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're finished. Don't judge. Just let yourself be loved back to health. I couldn't love myself. I was loved back to health, and I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did everything I was asked to do, and I was going to 2-3 meetings a day. And I got a sponsor, and God, what a life it was. I could not believe it. And I had a group called Shifters Group in Edmonton that I loved, and what they did for me was they taught me how to live in society again. And I remember the first time they gave me the key and said, you can open up and set up for the meeting. And I was amazed that they would trust me to do that because my family wouldn't give me a key. When they gave me money and said, go and get the coffee, and I brought back the change. Not a big deal, but something for me. Because I am a thief. I was a thief. And there was an old man called Ernie who used to say, Mary, if you feel like having sex, have it, but have it alone. It's a lot safer. He says, we usually say no relationships for a year, but for you it's two because you have a propensity for getting married. He said, I'm talking about a real relationship. So I listened to what Ernie was saying mostly, and my higher power was Bill Wilson when I came in, because I couldn't get a God of my understanding, I couldn't get back the God of my childhood, and I wanted the main man that wrote the book. And it worked for a little while, but then they said to me, "Mary, this book, it's about finding God." And the messenger comes in various shapes and sizes. One day I was down at the Alano Club in Edmonton and I heard this old gal, and she was the most spiritual woman I'd ever heard. Except she was saying things like, "As a drunken woman, I never went to bed with an ugly man, but I sure woke up with a few." She said, "But I don't do it anymore, I don't do it anymore, because I am a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous." And I went up to her afterwards and I said, "Who is this God you have? I'm looking for a God." She says, "Mary, my God's called Harold." I said, "Harold?" I was expecting something like Zeus. She says, "Well, you know that prayer, 'Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.'" She was pulling my leg, of course. Today I have a... I think that my God brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous so I could find my God. I believe there is only one God. I don't think it matters how you talk to him, in what language, or under what banner. I believe there only is one great spirit of the universe. And I believe that he is right here, right now, in this cathedral of the spirit. When I was about a year sober, I got a message saying my eldest boy would be going to school in Toronto, Canada. I called Intergroup, I had some AA people meet me, they drove me to the YWCA, and I moved to Toronto just before my 1 year medallion. They say you shouldn't move for a year, but I wanted to do that, and I was ensconced in the womb of AA. I lived at the YWCA, I got a little job, and then I got a better job. I got a little apartment, and I was able to see my boy. I got very involved in AA in Toronto. I got a wonderful sponsor, Renee, who then had about 40 years sobriety. She was marvelous. Now, here's what happened to me. Ernie had promised me a real relationship when I was 2 years sober. After my boy had done a year's schooling, he went back to Jamaica. And I'm almost 2 years sober, and I'm looking good. And I go to my Sunday morning AA meeting, and I look down the table, and I see him. And I just know that God has sent me my reward. And he's looking back at me with those AA eyes. You think the light in the eyes of the people is spirituality, but sometimes it's psychosis. And you know what happens when you meet and you fall in love and AA and you're both still very sick? Now, I know some people 2 years sober are well and can have a wonderful relationship, but that wasn't me. And that wasn't him. And what happens is you still go to a lot of meetings because you want to see him or her. And someone asks you to read how it works and your eyes stood across a clouded room. And you just know that God is shining down and you and him are going to walk under the circle and the triangle into the sunset. And when you go to these meetings, you have on your peacock feathers. And you strut your stuff. My sponsor says, "Don't get married because you're an emotional retard." And I knew she was jealous. So John and I eloped. Now let me tell you what happens to those peacock feathers in the close intimacy of marriage. When you're both that sick and you haven't had the personality change that's promised through the working of the 12 steps, is that when you're together on an intimate basis every day, One by one, the peacock feathers start dropping off. And in the end, all you have is the same two old turkeys sitting staring at one another. I love John and John loved me, but we just couldn't live together. Old Ernie called me from Edmonton and said, I hear you're in a lot of trouble. I think you should go back to the Y. It was very difficult to go back to the YWCA when you're 5 years sober. It's not easy. I went back, I walked out in that home and left everything because I was afraid. I was afraid. I didn't want to drink, but it was very emotional. And when I went to the Y, I knelt down outside and I said, show me the way, God. I said the third step prayer and I said, I don't know what's good for me, God. You do. Show me the way. And I got a little job, and again I got a better job, and I got a better job. I moved out the YWCA, I got a little apartment. And then I got a call from Jamaica to say my two boys were acting up and had gone to live with their old mother, old grandmother. And I went to my sponsor, I said, Renee, I'm going to go back to Jamaica. She said, go and make amends to the islands. I went back to Jamaica. I lived with my old ex-mother-in-law, my two sons, for a little while, not long, because they wanted to leave, and one went to Florida and one went to Scotland. I got very active in AA in Jamaica. I started writing for the Jamaican Daily Greener there and working with the poor people. And I was able to give something back to this island that I had taken so much from. I got a call in 93, and John, the man I had married in AA, said he wanted to sign a separation agreement, a legal separation agreement. And after 2 years in Jamaica, I went back to Toronto, Canada. And this is something I want to share to you about the way we get to make amends. My mother and father were both dead when I sobered up. They didn't know if I would ever get sober. They didn't even know where I was. And I had a lot of amends to make to people who were dead. Well, John asked me to sign a separation agreement, which I did. And I moved into an apartment in the same building because my two sons were coming to live with me. 10 days later, I was supposed to meet with John and he didn't show up. And I rang his phone, and no answer. And I went up because I still had a key for his door and turned the key and the door was bolted on the inside. And I had the door kicked down and I found John lying on the floor. He'd had a massive stroke. The last they'd seen him was AA meeting on a Tuesday night and I found him on Thursday night. The doctors tell me he'd been lying there for 2 nights, all alone, on that cold floor. When I saw him, I'd never ever felt such compassion for a man. He couldn't move, he was paralyzed. And I held him till the ambulance came. And I said, if you live, I will look after you. No matter if there's a legal separation agreement, I will look after you. He was in hospital for about a year. He could never speak again. He couldn't understand the spoken word very well, and he had a right arm paralysis. But I took him home. And what I did there, and I believe that God gave me, and please keep an open mind, I'm just saying how I relate to my God, is that my God said, Mary, you weren't able to look after your children, you weren't there for your parents, I'm going to give you John. And it was the most spiritual form of loving that I have ever known. And we had a wonderful few years together. And I would take him to my AA conventions if I could drive there. I'd drive him up and down to Florida. And as I say, he couldn't speak, but he'd look at me sometimes. He'd just look and he'd pat my face. And AA gave me that opportunity. John died 2 weeks ago. I held him till his body grew cold. And then I had them come for him. And it was the end. And I knew that God said, okay, I'm going to give him peace now. And your amends here for this particular part are over. He suffered dreadfully in the end. But I owe so much to God for that opportunity. My two sons, as I said, came back to me of their own volition in 1993. We lived together for 2 years. Until I couldn't stand it anymore. I mean, I love them so much and they love me, but they're crazy. And now they are self-supporting through their own contributions. Three years ago, my eldest son got married out in British Columbia. And I flew out there, and his father flew up from Jamaica. And him and me walked my son down the aisle. Now what is that but a miracle? 20 years ago I had hired 2 Jamaican gunmen to shoot him. He doesn't know that. I'm so grateful to God that I didn't. And he's looking at me and saying, "You're doing so well, isn't it wonderful?" And I think to myself, "You were almost toast, my friend." Thank you, God. 2 years ago, my youngest son got married in Toronto. My son, who was born in Jamaica, got married in a kilt in a Ukrainian Orthodox church. That's my boy. And he danced with me to a tune called Mama. Last year, last November, my son in BC presented me with a little grandchild called Nina Mari. And this May, my other son gave me a little grandchild. I was outside the birthing room for the whole experience. And her name is Maya. And the week after we buried my husband, we baptized my little grandchild. And please God, those little grandchildren will never ever smell the alcohol in my breath. The amends have not been easy. My son saw much, and it took me a lot of work. But in the end, I had to walk the walk. Talk is cheap. It is action, is the magic word. And we have a wonderful relationship today. And there are many things in my life that I could never have believed could have happened. I have a meaningful life today. Alcoholics Anonymous is my dedication and my love. There is a thing called a terminus, which means a sacred place. And that's what this is for me. This is my sacred place. I had to learn many lessons because I always had an edge. I didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous was about taking away the edge. I thought if I lost my edge, I would be nothing. It is a hard thing to give up the edge because you become vulnerable. But I was able to do it. And there's 2 little stories I'll share before I sit down. I used to be a thief, a big time thief. And when I was about, when God's ready to remove your defects of character, he'll take them away and you'll never get them back again. Now, I would never steal anything when I came into AA, but I always had the little edge, the little hustle, you know. And when I was about 8 years sober, I went to a supermarket and I wanted to buy a cantaloupe. And I look at the cantaloupe and it's $2.50. I said, "I'm not paying $2.50 for a cantaloupe." So I get all my other shopping and I check out. At the bottom of the checkout counter is a bag with a cantaloupe in it. And I say, "It must be God." I take home the cantaloupe, I eat it. I had an envelope with $40 in it to give somebody. I could not find that envelope anywhere. I call my sponsor and I told her what happened. She said, "Well, you got to take back the cantaloupe." I said, "I ate it." She says, "Well, you got to go and make amends and pay the money for the cantaloupe." So I go back to the supermarket. Well, I mean, like I told you, I was a big time thief and I have 2 sleepless nights over a cantaloupe. I go back to the supermarket. I always lie when I'm trying to be honest. And I spoke to the produce manager. I said to the manager, I said, "I inadvertently took a cantaloupe." She says, "Well, do you have it?" I said, "I ate it." "But I'd like to pay the money." He said, "Well, that's very kind, but we can't take your money unless you have the cantaloupe. But we really appreciate your honesty." I went home and guess what? I found my $40. Does that mean that God's playing hide and seek with my $40? I don't know. But all I know is this, that when I, as you go, as this is how I see it, as I go along the spiritual road, it becomes narrow. The hustles and the things I used to get away with in my early sobriety are not there for me anymore. Everything I do now, I will have to pay back immediately. The spiritual life becomes as sharp as the edge of a razor. And that is what keeps me straight. I want to be a good human being, but no matter how spiritual you get, you never rise above human being. But now, what keeps me there is God. My God has a thunderbolt. People say to me, God wouldn't hurt you. I say, not your God. Mine would. And the other little thing is this miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and what it's all about and what. A couple of years ago, I was watching this show. I think it was CNN. And these two men came out, doctors. And they said, we are going to penetrate the alcoholic mind. And I'm sitting there saying, don't go unless you have to. It's scary stuff. So they were going to do all these tests on alcoholics, you know, the controlled drinking studies. Oh God, what that must be like, a controlled, can you imagine, think about it, a controlled drinking study. And then they were getting alcoholic cadavers and cutting them up and looking at them and all kind of things. So they kind of fast-forwarded. And now these doctors are going to give their findings. And their first finding was that the alcoholic brain is structurally different to the normal brain. No kidding. If they drank what we drank, their brain would be structurally different. Their second finding is that alcoholism is a mystery. Bill Wilson said once that Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of utter simplicity encased in a mystery. Bill Wilson said once that we don't have churches, we don't own buildings. He says, what happens is when we get together, it becomes alcoholics joining together in a room like this, which was just an empty room before. It becomes the cathedral of the spirit. And the floor becomes paved by the 12 steps. And the walls become enclosed by the 12 traditions. And the spiral is the hand of service reaching towards God. This is the cathedral of the spirit. We are the most fortunate people in the world. I owe my life to Bill and Bob and to the people who came in the early days before the traditions, who died to give us what we have here. I am so very fortunate, because without Alcoholics Anonymous, I am truly nothing. Without the God of my understanding, I am truly nothing. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a success story. Rather, it is the chronicle of our colossal human failure turned to usefulness by the divine alchemy of a loving God. And thank you for having me.